The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. C. Derek Varne is an emerging poet, professional teacher, and armchair theorist. He is a member of the Zero Books team, and he is also the guest this week as we discuss the late 90s zine culture, historical developments in teen sexuality, how it is that talking about the war on terror produces evergreen content, and his new book of poetry entitled Apocalyptics. Turning to Zero Books, I should point out that Matthew McKeever's thought experiment novella entitled Coming From Nothing is available for pre-order right now. Coming From Nothing is a tragic comic love story concerned with notions of identity, such as Judith Butler's idea that sexual identity isn't determined by the body, and John Locke's idea that personal identity is a question of memory. I want to thank Christopher C., Never Speaks in Absolutes, that's a name, Ross N., and Philip K., for becoming members of the Inside Zero Books podcast this week. There are about 267 other patrons of the Inside Zero Books podcast, and all of them together are making Zero Books digital content production possible. If you enjoy the podcast, you might consider becoming a patron too. You'll get access to a second podcast every week, including monthly installments of Derek Varne's podcasts, Symptomatic Redness, and Alternatives. The music you're listening to right now is from Mark Hosler. It's a live performance in Tucson, but in just a moment you'll be listening to see Derek Varne and I discuss the poetry of teenage sex and endless war. Derek Varne, see Derek Varne. Your book is called Apocalyptics.
Yep.
It's published by Unlikely Books.
Yep.
Out of New Orleans.
Correct.
So it's a collection of poetry.
Yep. About 100-page long book poetry.
All right. Well, it's nice having you on.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. So.
Completely different for your listeners for us to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is not what we would normally be talking about. So before we jump into the poems themselves, and maybe I'll have you read a couple of them, how did you find this book publisher, and how
they
did you come to write these poems?
John Pinton, the editor, has been writing a form of this, what was originally an e-zine in literature, but became sort of a journal, since about 1998, and he was the second or third place that published me.
In a magazine or journal?
No, in an e-journal at first, and in a magazine, like in a book later.
An anthology of poetry?
An anthology later, yeah, like a physical anthology.
Uh-huh.
But he published me when I was 17 years old, and then I quit. Uh-huh.
When was that?
97, 98. It can be 97, so it must have been. He published a poem that I wrote when I was 17 years old, so it was more like 18. But it's so long ago, I barely remember it. Like, and I published a bunch of that stuff, and then I worked with him again like 4 years later, and I didn't work with him for a long, long time. And he developed a book line. And then The first thing he asked me to do for book line, about 2008 was he asked me to come in after I got my MFA and work his art section, because I was also...
So you got published by this publisher when you were 18 years old.
Yep, and then...
Before you went off to get your college degree, undergrad degree, but when you were still in high school or just out. And then you went off to college, you got a literature degree
as an
undergraduate?
An undergrad, and then...
You went to the graduate school. Where did you go to
graduate school? I went and got a job, but, you know, completely different story, and then went to graduate school. And then was, like, publishing and other, like, you know, more print journals, actually, at this point.
Yeah, after graduate school.
After graduate school. And then he asked me to work with him on another thing.
Did you keep in contact with him all
the time? No. Sometimes we fall off. Like,
how many poems did he publish of you?
About 10 or 15.
When you were in your teens.
Yeah, and then he published some... He published one or two of these, actually, when I first wrote them, and this would have been, like, 2007. And then I just didn't do anything with it. I shot this book around to about 20 different publishers. I originally had showed it to him in a different form, and he rejected it.
Oh, okay.
And,
Well, it's odd. Okay, I'll just tell you. I got published when I was 18. Actually, yeah, I was 18. I was in high school, senior year. And my first short story got accepted by a magazine. And I never published it again.
Mm-hmm.
But in the realm of poetry, I guess, I guess my question would be, did this publisher develop and become a more serious publisher
as
you went to college and got...
Yeah, completely separate from me. And actually, he was anti-MFA and all this other stuff. But, you know, but yeah, he became more and more... Basically, you know, he became more and more serious. He started publishing with little chapbooks and, you know, like handmade books. And then he started publishing real books and he warehoused them. And now he does these, which are small print runs, but he continuously keeps them up. So
where would people be able to find this book?
His website or Amazon. You can find it on Amazon. You can find them on probably Powell's. I think you can find them on most.
And the publisher is not an academic. He's not a
poet. No, he's not academic. He's supported by sales of these kinds of books and by Patreon. He doesn't even have Patreon and Kickstarter. That's how he used to do it.
Oh, so that's what funds publishing of these, the publications of these books?
Yeah, originally he funded them purely off sales. But that model became unsustainable around the 2000s.
And he made a living from publishing poetry.
Yeah.
Before then. Yeah.
And editing and doing a bunch of other stuff.
Right. So like me, he was a writer.
He was a writer and an editor. And he still is. He doesn't publish his own books anymore. he used to. But
he gets other publishers to publish his books.
And I did, you know, this book was, went around the award circuit, and I did, like, I get especially, so if you know how literary stuff in journals, usually your first book is an awards book, but, like, you submit it, and if you do well, they'll send you notes, but even if you don't get it, you don't get anything for it, and you usually pay money, actually.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I pay my $25 fees, and I get notes like, oh, you know, were in top 100, but nothing. So I was just always the bridesmaid, never bride, for about a decade, and kept on rewriting the book. Rewrote it over and over and over again.
Did you rewrote these poems a lot of times?
I would say some of these poems were rewritten like 10 times. Some of them were not rewritten at all, but I would change what was in here. So like I would cut stuff out of the book.
All right. So contemporary poetry. Mm-hmm. Are there schools that are dominant? Is there a couple of approaches to writing poetry that's very popular today, are we at a point where there's just a whole bunch of differences?
So, there were schools that were dominant. But there's experimental poetry and non-experimental poetry and, like, MFA poetry, New York poetry. The thing is, all that has kind of collapsed. Particularly in 2007, there was this anthology called Hybrid Form, which was these people who kind of did experimental verse, but also kind of did, like, normal verse. And my stuff falls into that, too. Some of it's experimental, some of it's not.
Mm.
Like, I don't completely abandon narrative. I don't embrace language poetry, which is all, you know, just non-narrative poetry.
Yeah, it just sounds really...
Right. I'm not... You know, there are epileptic narratives to this. Like, there are things that are going on. There are speakers that show up and go away, but they are not, it's not transparent on purpose.
So you would say a lot of it is experimental?
I would say not so much anymore. I wouldn't say that now. I mean, here's the thing. Like, experimental compared to what? I would have, when I started writing this, yeah, I would have thought that. But I don't think so anymore. I think it's just more of playing with the voice. I mean, some of these poems are awfully conventional and some of them are not.
Well, when I look at them, what I notice first is, just looking at them, not reading them, is that some of them look like... they're designed to almost make a picture. What is that called? Concrete poetry?
Concrete poetry. That's not concrete poetry. That's what that is analogous form. So...
What's concrete poetry?
Concrete poetry is like it's designed to make a picture and it looks like what it's about.
Right. And I almost think that this would do... is trying to do that, but then I look closely and I don't see the picture. Right. So instead you are...
I'm doing what's called analogous form. So like... where it's meant to be read, where you can read it some ways and not others, but there's obviously an easy way to read it.
All right, so there's a poem here called "Learning to Fall,"
mm-hmm.
and if you just read from left to right, it reads. I'm just going to read the first few lines.
Okay? Go ahead.
The glitter dust in the carpet is all the more breathtaking as I stare face down against the floor. I press against the streaked plum purple of my fractured rib to travel down into the railing and have your blood pulse each square inch of skin illuminated by a floodlight of a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to stop there.
Right, and you'll read it.
How would I read it a second way?
So, you would read it, the glittered dust face down, my to travel illuminated, tossed about to the calibrated, a pelican, her voning, a myth, ache, towards, into, could, now, stars, by, falling. Now, this way is obviously narrative.
Right.
This way is obviously not, but these words are thematically linked. And right. Also, like, the pauses in here are actually indications on how you should read it. So, like, it's staccato... The rhythms are staccato, so like...
Did I read it?
Yeah, you read it close to how it's supposed to be read. So, the glittered dust and the carpet is all the more breathtaking as I stare face down against the floor. I press against the streaked plum purple, my fractured rib, to travel down. And then note here, pronoun change, point of view shift.
Where's that?
Into the railing and have your blood pulse instead of my blood pulse.
Right. But it still could be the same person talking.
Yeah, it is. But it's deliberate. Like, that's deliberately to be confusing because it's supposed to mirror the experience of falling and being disoriented.
Right. So what's happened is you are starting the sentence as if you're falling and you're now saying, no, I'm really talking about you falling.
You falling. Yeah. And why this is analogous form is it's not making a picture. It's supposed to make you... Like, the disorientation of how, the just staccato it is supposed to make you disoriented, like the speaker of the poem.
Uh-huh.
So, like, it's purposeful. It's not just, like, me spreading out all the page because it looks cool.
Right.
But it is not really, like, a picture.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, I realized that after I looked and looked. I said, no, there's no picture.
Right. And so some of them are more explicit than others. For example, there's another poem in here that I've never published in another form because it's too hard to publish and it's too big. So this is called Composition in Motion. These And you, this is a great thing for a podcast because you totally can't see this.
You can't see it at all.
But you will notice there are like basically like a four triangle. Columns, yeah. And it's in a triangle, right? Well, this column is one set of events. This column is another set of events, and this column.
Okay,
is
so let me just see if I read it from top to bottom, left to right, I would read here, which is not in any of the columns.
Like no, this, it's right? not, and right. it's
so I'd read the mystical is not how the world is, but that it is. By Ludwig Wittgenstein, Tractatus Logico Philosophicus. There, right. I said it right. All right, now, starting on your first line. Last night I almost choked on the smoke that drenched my shirt. The remainder of women, tensely woven together, through limbs, twisting, in music or wind, I almost evaporated in wisps, engrossed. And then I'm going to go to the next column.
Right.
In the philosophy of moment. I can't speak, can't rattle on. For once, there is no new silence, no odious babble about nothing much. Nothing new. I'm going now to the next column.
Right.
The thin curve of the road like tendrils and shrouding streetlights. But I could have just read
the and first this column. You really can read it straight down. Last night, engrossed, unpacked paradigms of bodies fueled by scotch and gin, left to the left, hard steered, heated with compact muscle or sinew. Or you could read this. Nothing new. Nothing thin like the curve of streetlight, like roads like tendrils and shrouding streetlights, something inhuman rising from the steam of the street. Now, here you actually can make a narrative of each column.
Right. And so if you do read down, then you just keep reading this column two right. and this column two?
Right. And okay. then, but they interrupt each other because they're stream of thoughts. And yes, you are meant to read them in both ways. And
so to read that poem, you need to read it twice.
You need, yeah, and to read it out loud is almost impossible. That, where you have five columns and things going on simultaneously. It's actually written, I was listening to a lot of John Adams and Philip Glass, and we actually talked about this earlier today. But yeah. I was, and so like this
you
year.
You said they were con artists.
Oh, Dan, I still think that. I particularly Philip Glass. But at the time, I thought they were doing something interesting. So this here is like, you can, like, to read this the way it's written, you have to read all five columns simultaneously, which is impossible to do, and so I don't perform this poem,
right?
And I've only published it in book form because it's even hard to get on a page. Like you can't put it in a like on an e-journal. It would be nearly impossible to format. We could talk about the cover.
Yeah, the cover's nice. It's got the collage there.
A nice collage by the artist Adrian Kenyon, who's a British artist living in France. Got Trump and Kim Jong-un, although when I picked this collage series, there's a series of them, that was originally George Bush and Osama bin Laden, which is appropriate because those are references that are made in the book. The right. backdrop is the Afghan and Iraq wars.
Did the publisher ask the collage artist to change it?
No, it was changed for different reasons, but the publisher was like, this will make it, you know, sell. And I was like, oh, and I actually told them, like, you can do that, but... And I'm not going to oppose you doing that, but the book's not about Trump at all. There's not a single reference to anything, after 2015, except the Afghan war is evergreen, apparently, so I can always make references to bombs in Kabul and probably be accurate.
God, that's horrible.
I mean, you know, it is a morbid fact about this book. Is that some of these poems were totally written when I was 21, 22, 23, so like in 2001, 2002, 2003. And when they make Afghan war references, and then I make Afghan war references in poems that were written in 2012, they look like they were written at the same time because the war is everything.
It starts with an earthquake, bird, snakes, an airplane, Kemosabe, not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself, turn. World starts its own age, not your knees. Feet off, wrong speed, run. No strength, the ladder starts. Battle with fear, fight down, hot wire, and fire representing seven games. Government for hire, and a combat side. Left west coming in, hurry with your feet down your neck. Team game, border, battle, trump, dead, rock. Look at that low lane. Fine, then, overflow, population, time, and food. Don't take yourself, serve yourself. World starts its own age,
since you hardly done me with the rapture and the river and the right. Right. Patriotic, patriotic, stand by, right, right. Feeling pretty psyched.
It's the end of the world as we know it.
I know it, you know it.
It's the end of the world
as we know it, as we knew it.
It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
Waterboarding is misnamed.
I would think the best way to think about a book like this, both in the regular poems, the poems that look like the way you think a poem would look,
right,
and the poems that don't, is to think of it impressionistically. I'm writing about subjective impressions of things that are happening, and they're obscured because, I mean, some of it obscures me playing little games in the earlier poems, but in the later poems, they're obscured because I'm also trying to, like, get to feelings of confusion about the way you handle the way, like, the world in your personal life will sometimes feel like they're rhyming, but also completely not related because you're not a total narcissist.
Right, or a solipsist.
Yeah, but you might, at moments, that's confusing because it feels like maybe the mood of the world and your own personal mood are mirroring. You know, that there are things coming into your own experience that aren't from you.
You know, I felt that way more often when I was younger.
Right.
That the world outside, the world of politics, the world as the world, and my own personal life and mental state, mood, were simpatico. And in the last few years, really, and it's really the last few years, that feeling has faded. I feel like I'm not in step with the world, or it's not mirroring my own inner space so much.
Well, I feel like what made a lot of these interesting to write, and what they were kind of about, is when you'd feel like they were simpatico, like you were watching the news and you were having, you know, like that poem I was making, Love the Sons of Televised War, which comes out of like reading too much J.G. Ballard, but it's also like literally the experience of like, oh, you're making out with someone.
Well,
there's news on the phone, and then like for a second you lose track of what you're doing with the person, and the news interrupts you, and then it could be something banal, like, I don't know, but it could be something like there's another bombing. And another backdrop from my personal life that'll make some of this make a little bit more sense is at this time, part of it I was working for an actuarial service, but the other part of it, like when I was getting my MFA, I was also working at a military college, mm-hmm. You know, teaching at night.
Yeah.
And so I would come in, and I would sometimes be teaching people who were very much coming back from that world. And a lot of people I knew had fought in the Iraq War. I mean, like, I knew a whole lot of people, because I'm from Central Georgia, that was their way out. So that was constantly a real thing. Like, it was a real thing in my life where I would know people who come back maimed from this. And it only became more real later on, actually, when I left the country.
So do you feel the same, that you... Do you think that the time of the war of Iraq after September 11th and the time of the invasion of Afghanistan was a time in which it was easy to see your own feelings expressed in the world, that people have become more alienated from the world? I mean, even though that was a feeling of alienation and disruption, that the disruptions and alienation and the problems of the world are further away from us now. You can tune them out more easily.
I think they're more easily tuned out. Like, that I would say that. And I would also say they don't come up, even in my own poetry, like, they don't come up as much. Like, this book is selected from poems that are thematically related. So, like, you know, the poems that aren't about that aren't in here. This is not to say every poem is about the war. There's also a lot of stuff about gender tensions. There's a lot of stuff about, like, language identity issues. But the whole thing about Apocalyptics, and it came out of this, like, this was not the original title of this book. The original title of this book was Sometimes Great Bodies, which I was told was too depressing.
Oh.
Which is the title of the center poem. And they're like, well, what would you call it? Well, I went through the other poem, and I found the other poem that I thought hit the theme the right way, which was a later poem, but it's about, let me find it, it's actually about Y2K.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And kind of about the Iraq War, and it actually, it was written much more recently, but it was me reflecting actually on this time period. Too many lattes for memories to flow easily, but not whiskey to take it straight. Remembering sweat from the swelter as the Twin Towers fell. My girlfriend in Johnstown, but the phone's nothing but distant static. After everyone stopped crying, two young women kissed on the couch as we watched a movie to avoid the repeat of the news. I once read the way cell phones can mutate, growing overfinkant and exploding. No Jasper Johns, canvas blank enough, stark enough for the memory of a woman stripped to her bra and panties, crying at a party at the turn of the millennium, the weight of zeros hitting her core as she partly strip-teased away to the future in the champagne haze. One wants to see so much. I have been to the remains of the cave on Patmos. Nothing but historical markers and rocks. My father, my king, my fear of sex addiction, like Cicadas Carpes, I woke with a lover between me and another man on New Year's Eve. When I return to the places where the night stays dark, I see myself emerging from a soft exoskeleton, sore from all the changes that I am. Mm. And so this is actually about that time period. I didn't write it in that time period.
Right.
So this is actually probably one of the actual autobiographic poems where, like, you know, you're 19 and 20, you are reacting to what is immense tragedy, and you're doing it by basically kind of hedonistic abandon, but not because you're really being hedonistic, but because it's just something to take your mind off of what is going on, because you have no control of it. And from Y2K to 9/11, through that time period, I just remember there was a lot of that. I mean, partly it's just you're 19 or 20.
Yeah.
You're drinking, you know, you don't really know your alcohol limits. You're spending a lot of time out, and there's a lot of sex, and you're in college. But a lot of it's also just, I think it was specific to the time. I don't think a lot of late high schoolers and older college students experience that world the way I did. I mean, when I talk to I teach high school now, and you know that they're not doing, I mean, like, even though they're experimenting with gender, they're not actually experimenting that much with sex.
Really?
Stuff like that. Yeah. I'm not saying that the kids are not, you know, they're not all black pilling themselves and they're nothing, but there isn't as much interest in it.
Hmm. In sex.
Yeah. And there's stats to back that up, too.
Yeah, I know that, but...
But I'm like, even talking to the students, they're just not... They're like, I don't have time for that. Like, they don't date in the same way. And there might be hookups, but they're not... Like, hookups are not usually of the experimenting with sex sort of thing. They're more mechanical transactions in a lot of ways.
Hmm.
So...
I don't know.
You're a total normie in this regard, Doug. But I mean, like, for me, like, this is what I was writing about, and then I was writing about a marriage that was both, actually, some of the people that I say I for are not me in here. They're like people that I know who when I was writing this.
Well, I was 19 and 18. I mean, just go back to defending myself from being a normie. In the 80s, you know.
Yeah.
So,
like, in the AIDS scare, right?
No, well.
Kind of, but not really.
Not for me. I had several girlfriends, but I didn't have any hookups.
Right.
I fooled around. I would go on dates. I made out in the back of a car.
See, we would fool around. I don't think these weren't hookups either. Like, these were just, but we would get weirder, I think, probably. I mean, and that's not...
Well, I think that this... Yeah.
I mean, that's not me bragging either. I think that really was, like, it wasn't just me. It was, like, a general milieu that we were in, and, like...
Well, what do you mean by weirder?
I think we were, like, we...
Would you tie each other up and stuff?
Well, shit, maybe.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I also think there's stuff involved in that... That has to do.
So, yeah, then I am a normie. I never tied up my high school girlfriends or had them tie me up. And, you know, nor did it ever occur to me to ask for that kind of thing.
But, what, you know, I have to think we were asking, because that's, like, what we were. Like, for example, the movie that we were watching, I actually remember that night. This was the night after 9/11.
What was it?
It was Sod.
Oh.
The Jeffrey Rush movie about Marquis de Sade. And we were watching, like, we didn't have it because it was 9/11. That was just the movie that we had.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and so that was kind of in the air, in a way. And, like, polyamory was being talked about as a thing, but it was kind of still hush-hush. But that was, like, I think The Ethical Slut had just been published, and everybody was, like, kind of flirting with that stuff. But no one was really serious about it either. I think we're forgetting, like, historical context in a way that, like, for me, my high school years, we didn't fool around much either, but because we had the AIDS scare drilled into our head from age 6 to age 18. And when we realized...
You heard about it.
Yeah, you heard about it. But, like, from when I was a kid, like, a little kid, they're like, you could get the AIDS and, like, you know, and, you know, like, when I was 8 years old is when they figured out really what it was, even.
Right.
So I grew up with that. So there's none of the, like, fun sexual liberation stuff of, like, the 70s and 60s in my background. And so when we realized we weren't going to all die, I think we went a little crazy.
Right.
But then the world seemed insane, too. Like, you had 9/11. And while, in retrospect, 9/11 was massive, it also isn't massive in this weird way. And even at the time, like, I remember talking to people and they thought, like, oh, this was going to become a common occurrence and things were going to get crazy. It was going to be like the 70s, but now, like, people were dying in the thousands because it was also, like, Oklahoma City bombing had happened.
Yeah. That was well before, but...
Yeah, but it was when I was 16.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm beginning to write these poems. And now that poem is written, like, the poem that I read to you was written, and, like, it's written in probably 2014. So it's actually not from that time period.
Right.
But it's about that time period. That's when I started writing this book.
So it's for, like, for me, the fear was, you know, will you get her pregnant? Don't.
Yeah, but I mean, like, everyone I knew was on the pill.
Right.
Like, even, and probably before they were sexually active, like, half of them were on, half the women I knew on the pill at the time were, like, on it because it was prescribed for PMS to regulate that.
Well, I'm talking about before I was actually doing anything, what my fears were, more than, you know, the girls or women I was with would have been on the pill. But beforehand, I was not afraid of AIDS.
I definitely was.
Yeah.
My aunt had AIDS,
for,
by the way.
That was for gay people.
No, but my aunt had AIDS.
Yeah.
Okay. But I'm also like, this is different. Like,
it's a 10 years difference.
It's a 10 years difference, and it definitely wasn't just for gay people in the early 90s.
It wasn't just for gay people ever, but...
Right, yeah, I know, but yeah. But there was a... but, like, in 88, it was still called, like, the gay cancer.
Right.
I don't remember... I remember that being a... Or maybe not 80, maybe it's 86, but, like...
Yeah.
I remember being a thing from when I was a very little kid, but I'm so young, like, I'm not even 10 years old, that, like, I don't even know what that means.
Right.
By the time that I'm old enough, like... You know, people, but I had to get in, like, I had blood transfusions as a child.
Oh, yeah, and people were afraid.
And people were afraid that, like, we might have AIDS. And then, I had an aunt who did get AIDS.
From a blood transfusion?
No. From probably intravenous drug use.
Yeah. I'm just going to say some old man kind of stuff real quickly, and then we can go back, you can go back. Say, like, I think my parents' generation would fool around. I don't know exactly what they did, but they certainly wouldn't talk about certain things that my generation would talk about.
Right, but they probably did them more than your generation did.
Maybe. Well, I'm talking about, like, oral sex.
Yeah.
That was never going to be something that
you wouldn't talk about it. Yeah. Like, yeah, and my parents
didn't either. But my generation did talk about that.
Right.
But no one would talk about, until I was in college, no one talked about, like, you know, handcuffs or games or anything like that.
Right, and we did.
In high school.
Ish. It was a joke in high school at first.
Right.
Like, I remember I was writing for zines. You know, this is kind of, like, why I like this aesthetic, because this is also kind of where it come out of, is the zine culture.
Right.
Like, I think you and I reminisced before about, like, being in Fact Sheet 5 at one point.
Right. Right. We both were.
Yeah, different. But I was, like, 16.
Right. And I was 23.
Yeah, and they were also, like, they were crappy zines, but, like, I would make jokes about, like, S&Ms. Like, you'd have little, like, candies. And, like, it was just, like, a joke. We didn't really understand it, but it was enough in the air that when we turned and we got into college, we were doing all kinds of things. And I think the other thing that's like that we forget about now is like sex positive feminism was a thing. I don't know how I feel
in
about
the 90s, that. Yeah, in the late
90s, early 2000s, like
yeah.
And it seems so foreign. I mean, even to me now.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and I'm not. I actually like part of this book is like I don't think that was all good, either.
No.
I think a lot of it was meaningless. I think a lot of it was, I think a lot of people got emotionally hurt, and I think a lot of people got very confused more than anything else. And then the subtext of this book is a lot of people ran, as far as like my experience, they ran towards religion. They ran towards a kind of conservative, and I did too. Like I didn't become religious. I became sort of like an anti-war conservative. But that was the backdrop. But I was just trying to find something to ground from all the shit that seemed insane. And that's what this book was about. That's why it's written in the form that's written in. And so, like, it's about being utterly disoriented. It's about, like, there's a couple. There's a poem in here about, like, a couple. And this actually, this is a story I heard. Mm-hmm. And a couple where the woman in the couple makes out with a crossdresser and is experimenting.
Oh yeah, I read that poem. Like I read that poem today.
Go ahead. And there's jealousy, and there's not supposed to be, and like there's this weird implicit threat of violence that you know doesn't end up happening because there's basically a car wreck,
right?
And so I wrote this into a poem, and because it was like an apocryphal story that I heard from a friend's ex-girlfriend or something. And I was fascinated by this whole, like, this idea that these people were experimenting with liberation. But they were also, like, becoming weirdly possessive and violent, like, conversely, even though the whole reason they were doing this was the opposite of that.
Right, to let each other go, to let each other be free.
Right, and it was ended up being more possessive and more weird, and because they hadn't really worked out all their jealousies and shit before they tried it.
Andrea Dworkin, sex. What is it for?
I think you should be addressing that question to somebody with omniscience. I don't have omniscience. I'm asking questions about the relationship between intercourse and women's civil status. And why is it that women continue to be sexually subordinated to men, regardless of what social reforms we seem to be able to enact? What effect does intercourse have on our desire for freedom and for equality? Why is intercourse in a male-dominated society exactly synonymous with sex when there are so many ways that people can have pleasure that don't actually involve intercourse? And study after study has shown that for women, most other forms of sexual intimacy are actually a lot more pleasurable and fulfilling. So what I'm concerned about is, does intercourse take a lot away from women? Does it rob women of identity and of freedom and of a sense of selfhood and entitlement? And then what are the implications of that for women politically? Is it in the experience of intercourse that we learn to accept our second-class status?
Adriana Dworkin died, but she became relevant again.
Yeah. And I think that was 2007 she died?
I think she was a little bit before. It's like 2005. She died in the mid-2000s. I can't remember the year exactly. And then, like, I do remember around 2007, 2008, though, Female Chauvinist Pigs was written, and she was back in the discourse again a few years after her death. And I mean, I do think it was an understandable backlash to this.
Right.
And I don't think it was insignificant that all this was happening with the backdrop of war. And a lot of and the other thing is, like, a lot of these young adults that I'm writing about and remembering, and myself included, we were at a state college. We were most of us were from working class backgrounds, but we were not becoming working class people. And we were really lost because a lot of the people's parents that I'm writing about, they didn't go to college, and we had these expectations, and we didn't know what the hell we were doing. And that shows up in these poems, like, over and over again. And what's also showing up in these poems is this geopolitical context, which kind of clarifies things, but also doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't really know why. Like, why are we at this war? Why, like, I know why people are attacking us, but, you know, like, I understand that intellectually, but I don't get it. I don't understand why there's like, why everything feels apocalyptic. And that's why that's why this is named after this. I wrote an essay in the Time. It's I don't think you can even find it online anymore. It was about all the weird, the weird, like, you know, we forget of this about the late 90s, but like all the weird apocalypse culture that was going on.
What the hell do you think you're doing? Dragging your butt through the day, selling body and soul to a bunch of bland normals? Acting stupid so they'll think you're one of them? Tired of getting all of the guilt, but none of the sex? There is a simple answer, dear friend. A glowing beacon of slack amidst the turmoil and darkness. It's J.R. Bob Dobbs, the living slack master in his Church of the Subgenius. Bob brings a new destiny for the abnormal, for Bob comes to justify our sins, to unmask the conspiracy, and to get us back the slack they stole away. It's us versus them. Are you gonna fry in hell on earth alongside the pink boys, or will you pull the wool over your own eyes and accept Bob into your mind? Repent, quit your job, slack off, and praise Bob!
Church of the Subgenius, eternal salvation, or triple your money back.
And I also think, unfortunately, for the sake of this book took so long to get out that I don't think, like, the context is going to be immediately clear to a lot of people.